Hey, welcome once again to On Mic with Jordan Rich, a podcast for and about voiceover artists, actors, and performers of all kinds, including comics. On today's episode, we'll pay particular attention to stand-up comedy. And just to get you into the mood, here are the voices of some of the best.
Of course, you can't talk about Southern food without bringing up grits, right? Grits, it's like someone was like, hey, if you love the taste of biscuits and gravy, but without the taste of biscuits and gravy, then you'll love our man-made wet sand.
My freshman year of high school, I had to take a standardized test. Supposed to tell me what I had to do with the rest of my life. And my results came back and said that I had to either be a rocket scientist or run a laundry service. Or stop cheating off the Asian kid.
You ever have milk the day after the day? Scares the hell out of you, doesn't it? The spoon is trembling as it comes out of the bowl. It's after the day! I'm taking a big chance! I smelled it, you smell it, what is it supposed to smell like? It smelled like milk to me!
We learn, we're conditioned not to engage in full conversation, you know, because as soon as you start to talk to somebody, somebody's cell phone's going to go off immediately. Thank God they got rid of those obnoxious rings, huh?
Nice night, huh? I was upstairs laying on the bed thinking about the moves I was going to make with the wife. She was in the other room with a Pepsi bottle going, wah, 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 wah. Weirdo, weirdo, shakes Pepsi bottles to get me in heat. Get horny when you're up here, you know what I mean? Mexicans, you never fool around with the wife, right? You're too busy laying on the floor fixing the mud so it don't cave in. They never fool with the wives, the Mexicans. They're walking around the house going, turn on the television. Turn on the television.
Mahatma Gandhi once said, they asked him, Mr. Gandhi, what do you think of Western civilization? And he replied, I think it is a wonderful idea.
Just a few comedy giants right there, masters of stand-up. My guest today has had a hand in training some of the best comedians working today. He's Steven Rosenfield, who the New York Times refers to as the best-known comedy teacher in the country. Steve is the author of Mastering Stand-Up, The Complete Guide to Becoming a Successful Comedian. He's also the founding director of the American Comedy Institute, the premier stand-up comedy school in the U.S. Steve, welcome to my podcast. Great to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you.
Let's start, before we talk about Mastering Stand-Up, the brand new book, with the fact that you're the founding director of the American Comedy Institute, as I said in the introduction. I didn't know there was an American Comedy Institute. I'm thrilled. Tell me about the work you do there.
Well, the work grew out in many ways from what I had wished existed when I was starting out. We are a school that teaches comedy, writing, and performing in all fields, in stand-up, in sketch comedy, improvisation, comedy for television, and comedy late-night TV talk show comedy, and sitcoms, and web comedy, and internet comedy.
And you've had some interesting students, names we would recognize. You want to tell us about some of your students?
I guess, yes, sure. I always get in a bit of trouble with this just because of the people I don't mention. But I'll mention a couple. So Lena Dunham came here. This was the first place she came. She was, I still remember her. She was 16, I think. She was a sophomore in high school in Brooklyn. And I just recently sort of took a look at the video of her debut performance. It was really fascinating to see her that young and already creating very smart and very sexy comedy in a really appealing way. I mean, there was the thing that I remember about her as a student, actually, is she was really serious about this. She wanted to talk to me after it was all over, and she wanted me, you know, to give her my assessment as to what her potential was. And thank God, luckily I called it right.
You did. If it's the same Lena Dunham we know, you certainly brought a beautiful student of comedy into the world. And is Jim Gaffigan one of your alums as well?
Yeah, Jim studied here for, I think, about 18 months, almost 2 years. He had a very successful career. I believe he was at Gray Advertising. And the thing that was just so clear about Jim is that Jim was one of those people who absolutely did not give himself any time frame, which is really, I believe, the only way to go about this. He had made up his mind before he set foot on the stage that he was going to become a stand-up, and he never looked back.
We're talking here today with Steven Rosenfield, the founding director of the American Comedy Institute and the author of Mastering Stand-Up, The Complete Guide to Becoming a Successful Comedian. So I want to start with a pretty obvious question. Maybe it's a dumb question, maybe not. Does one have to be naturally funny to be successful as a stand-up, knowing how difficult stand-up is?
You know, the answer is no, surprisingly. Here, let me, I want to make a point here. Most people are naturally funny. Sense of humor, I think, is a very apt phrase because I think it is a sense, like taste, smell, touch. I think our sixth sense is not the ability to see the future, but to be funny. So it's been really, really rare for me to encounter someone who just had, you know, virtually no sense of humor. That's kind of hard to find.
Yeah, I think you'd have to be robotic to the nth degree to have no sense of humor. Even the most dry humor is funny. I mean,
of course. So. Yeah, no, but there have been, I think maybe in, you know, I've been doing this for 28 years, and I would say at the most one handful of people have just been beyond hope.
I've got to ask you to comment, because no one is more equipped to do so than you, on the actual art form of stand-up comedy, being up there by yourself in front of a group of strangers, many of them drinking, and working a crowd for 10, 20 minutes, an hour. That's an unusually challenging art form, isn't it?
It certainly is, but there's something that I want to point out, which is that, and you know, a lot of people think when they see a stand-up that they're just an incredibly funny person who's getting up on stage and talking to them. And what they don't realize is that, you know, if you see a comedian in any kind of major venue, including comedy clubs, they're doing their act. They're, you know, a great comedian is doing a great show. And like all great shows, there's great writing. Comedy is not written, it's rewritten. We have a huge advantage in that people either laugh or they don't. And if they don't, we got to fix it or we got to cut it.
Right.
And what you're seeing a show. You're seeing a show that may in fact have several people working on it, including the comedian. So I don't want to take anything away from, you know, how daunting and demanding it is, but it's a little bit less daunting when you realize that this is material that's been written and rewritten and honed, and it's a persona that you've developed. It's not you yourself getting up in front of a bunch of people drinking and you know, with them sitting there going, "Make me laugh." I mean, that would really be horrifying.
I can understand that. But so many comics who are friends of mine, of course, relate those experiences that everybody has in the world of comedy, the bombs, the jokes that fall flat, or the crowds that just aren't with you, or maybe they're a group of Japanese tourists who can't speak English. Everyone has that kind of story. Is this something that you focus on in teaching people the ropes, you know, be ready for that?
Absolutely. And, you know, there's several forms of bombing. Okay. One of them is, a joke doesn't work, and there's no reason to be concerned about that. You don't live or die by a single joke not working, and a lot of times, jokes that don't work, the audience doesn't see a punchline, so they don't even know anything went wrong. That's how poorly written your joke is, you know. But it can be a comfort to realize that. So you don't live or die by one joke not you know, bombing. The other thing is that there's a thing called a save, and that's what a comedian does to essentially get a laugh in recognition of the fact that his joke didn't work.
That's the Carson model, isn't it? The Johnny Carson.
You are so right.
Right.
You are so right. He was the master of that. Mm. And it was part of his, you know, I think he was a genius at what he did, that he could get us laughing at home whether his material worked or not in front of his audience.
Right, right, right. It's interesting, too, when you look at the successful comics down through the ages, most of them have something that's unique to them, whether it's a sound or a look or an approach. And I'm thinking of today's crop of very funny people, whether it's Stephen Wright or Jeselnik or Gaffigan or any of these guys, they have their own style. Is that something that you can help, that a teacher of your quality can help develop in someone if they're a little unsure as to what direction to take?
Yes. And what you say is so absolutely right. Originality, funny and original, those are the two things that the people who can really help people have careers are looking for. Not just funny, because it's possible to be generically funny and people will laugh at your jokes, but they don't really remember you. The people that you mentioned, they've established an indelible personality. I can be helpful with that because there's a process. It's understanding that the process of developing a persona is like sculpting, and your hands are on the wood or the marble, and so are the hands of lots and lots of audiences. And what I tell the comedians that I work with is that there are two questions you want to ask yourself when a joke kills. One is, what was I talking about? Because that laughter is an invitation by the audience for you to talk more about that subject. You found a subject that they love hearing you talk about. And number two is, what emotions did I play when I told that joke? Emotions are referred to as attitudes in stand-up. What attitudes did I play? Because that laugh is a signal that they love to hear you express those attitudes.
Right.
They find them funny coming out of you. And then there's similar questions to ask, which are painful at the time, but they're essential to learn, which is, if you find over time that you're not getting laughs, what subjects were you talking about? Because it could very well be that just because of chemistry, the chemistry between you and that particular subject is not working. And so you stop doing stuff about that subject. And you'll also discover that certain attitudes don't work for you.
Mm.
And so you don't write in those attitudes. So you find yourself talking about things that you and your audience love, and expressing emotions that have proven to be successful for you, and eliminating the ones that aren't.
Right.
So, like sculpture, there's less wood at the end than there was at the beginning. But what's there is really vivid and vital.
I'm a huge comedy fan, and I have not just local friends, but I've interviewed many of the greats over the years. I've had the honor of it. With me, I'm a little unusual in that I love the Jerry Seinfeld approach, but I'm also a Carlin fan, and I'm a Gilbert Gottfried fan, and yes, even a Larry David fan. And the reason I bring up Larry David and Gilbert Gottfried primarily is because these are the two guys who generally thumb their nose at what is considered, shall we say, appropriate. And most recently, Larry David on Saturday Night Live performance did a Holocaust-related joke and a few other things.
Right.
And I'm just wondering if there is anything to be said about those areas that are, quote, taboo, if there are any. What advice do you have the young comics who don't have the Larry David name, you know, how to approach material that may be tricky?
Okay. Well, there are two things here. I mean, one of them is, and I think there's some people who feel this way about what Larry David did, is that some taboos, you know, it's pretty wise to honor them. I think what you want to know as a comedian is by doing, let's take the Larry David situation where he did this thing about, you know, dating in a concentration camp. By doing the joke, you are diminishing the impact of that event. It becomes smaller, and I think you have to ask yourself whether or not you want to do that. And if you do, I mean, you know, the thing is, go ahead and give it a try. But just know that that's what you're doing. Taboos have been about, you know, the history of comedy is about going after taboos. And the thing is that in our time, in this kind of anything-goes world that we're living in, where, you know, Larry David's doing Holocaust jokes on Saturday Night Live, and Louis C.K. a couple of weeks ago was doing pedophile jokes. I mean, you're talking about national television here.
Right.
It's kind of hard to find stuff that's really taboo. Certainly sexual stuff isn't taboo anymore. Talking about sex graphically is not really taboo anymore. I mean, people can watch pornography on their cell phones.
Mm.
So to locate a genuine taboo is not so easy. And there's another thing I want to point out. I'm a huge Lenny Bruce fan, which is that let me put it this way: the more repressive the overground is, the stronger the underground is. And when you had people like Lenny Bruce around, or Moms Mabley around. They weren't just doing, they weren't thinking, what shouldn't I talk about? And that's what I'm going to talk about. Okay, so you can't talk about pedophilia, so I'll do pedophilia jokes. Before that, it was rape jokes. They were, you know, they were, it's like every other comedian you saw at a club had their rape jokes. But with the people who really did that kind of edgy comedy really, really well, they really believed in what they were doing. They weren't picking on things simply because they knew it would be outrageous to do jokes on it. They were really making a point in the face of an establishment that didn't want that to be discussed.
You make an excellent point, and Moms Mabley is a fascinating character. I remember when I was a kid watching her on the Merv Griffin Show, but
I
saw the Whoopi Goldberg documentary and realized these are people, and I'm not going to paint them as great heroes, all of them, but many people who, you know, took the issues of the day and through laughter and comedy were able to expose certain issues and make people think. And I think oftentimes comedy is considered the lesser art, but I think there's so much more truth in comedy many times that these guys and gals are doing it and doing it in challenging ways.
You know, it's the very fact that you say that makes me think of what sort of absurdly puritanical country we are. You know, I think in general, any entertainment where just regular people can derive enormous amount of pleasure without having it explained to them is looked down upon.
Mm.
You know, comedy's looked down upon. Jazz was looked down upon. Mm-hmm. The musical theater was looked down upon. It was looked down upon. The only people who didn't look down upon it were the millions and millions of people who adored it
exactly.
And who attended it.
Exactly. Jazz, what a perfect analogy. I think that's perfect because jazz was considered for outsiders and weirdos, and it's thrived through the ages, although not as popular as pop music, but we love it, we dig it, and that's the same thing with many comedians and many comedy art. We'd love to follow them and support them. In terms of mastering stand-up, to get a little bit more practical here, you have advice not only on the act and what's happening on stage, but how to actually get a gig. And is it easier now than it was in the 80s when there were so many comedy clubs popping up? Or what's the state of open mics today, as far as you know, Steve?
Okay. Well, here, let me make a distinction. In certain big cities like New York City, where on any given night the biggest stars in stand-up are on stages, at an open mic, there isn't going to be any regular audience there. It's only going to be the new stand-ups who are just there to, you know, get up and perform. So anybody can do that. That there's no barrier to that. The problem with that is that that kind of audience, it's not that they're a tough audience, it's just that they're not an audience. I mean, they're not there to go out and listen to comedy. They're there to wait to get on stage. I would say the biggest plus now is the internet, because it's incredible, and my students have benefited from this enormously. You get somewhere around 7 minutes. You get a good 7-minute video of your work, and you send it to, you email it to a manager of a club. They'll look at it. If they like the first 30 seconds, they'll keep looking at it. If they don't like it, they'll stop. If they like 5-6 minutes of it, they're going to book you. And that's amazing, because you can get booked, literally, you can get booked all over the world now without, you know, just via a really terrific video and using the internet. I would say that's, in terms of getting started, that has helped enormously, and that was not possible in the 80s.
One other thing, too, and this is something that I've talked about with friends. I'm always amazed at the originality and creativity of musicians who write songs that are different than any other song I've heard, and the same thing with comedy. But it is true, isn't it, that perhaps the number one cardinal sin is joke thievery. And there was a case of it in the last couple of years with a few well-known comics, one in particular. And I'm just wondering if that's something that is drilled into the heads of your students. Hey, a joke or an act or routine is intellectual property, really, isn't it? I don't know how.
Totally.
Yeah, and talk a little bit about that, if you will.
Well, the thing is, you know, it is frowned upon. And when people do that, they're stealing. I mean, you are stealing. You're stealing somebody's livelihood, because that's the way that comedian, you know, is making their living. And, you know, you're also stealing somebody's legacy, because I heard a very, very prominent comedian who will remain, who I won't say who it is, steal a Lenny Bruce joke. And Lenny Bruce is not around anymore. But by that comedian presenting it as something of their own, they're stealing his legacy. So it's serious. And the other thing is that, you know, we talked about this early on, Jordan. Originality is so important in this business, and you're not really going to get anywhere by stealing other people's material. I have to tell you this briefly. The only time I've ever heckled anybody, and this was a long time ago, it was at the Original Improv, and this preppy-looking kid who looked like, you know, he looked like he took the train in from old Greenwich, Connecticut, gets up on stage, and word for word, he's doing Woody Allen's material. And not only is he doing Woody Allen's material, Woody Allen did this hilarious material that was about the shtetl, about the Eastern European Jewish, you know, villages. And this kid is doing this stuff about this guy coming up to the rabbi, and it was just insane.
Oh, it does sound like somebody who's lost his mind to get up there to expect, in this internet age particularly, people not to know of the bit, right?
Exactly.
I'm surprised he didn't do the moose on the fender bit. I mean,
right? You know, I was relentless. I'm not proud of this, but but I was relentless, and I think he did give it. He may not just have had time to get to it.
Wow. Tell us how people can find out more about the Institute, the web address and so forth, and then I'll plug the book again for you.
Great. Sure. It's info@comedyinstitute.com. We'll get them there, or just Google the American Comedy Institute.
All right, I'm going to just say it right now. Bucket list for yours truly is to attend one of your courses and work on my skills.
That would be great.
I just love this stuff. And I think more and more people who read your book, even if they don't plan on going into the field, will have a better appreciation for what these people, men and women, do. And it's a intriguingly interesting art form. And the book is called Mastering Stand-Up, The Complete Guide to Becoming a Successful Comedian. And let me just ask you one more thing. Growing up as a kid, and I don't know how old you are, I'm guessing we're probably in the same age range. Did you have a favorite or two from the Ed Sullivan times or whatever? I mean, did you have an old school comic that really turned you on back then?
Boy, that's a really good question. I remember seeing Nichols and May. I remember seeing Jackie Mason.
Mm-hmm.
I remember Stilla and Mira appearing on that show. God, I remember Myron Cohen appearing on that show.
One of my favorites. And Alan King holds the record for being the most booked comedian on the Ed Sullivan Show, I believe. Alan King.
Yeah, that makes sense. And they were all terrific. I would say maybe my secret favorite. And again, he's a little bit after those. But when Don Rickles used to be on the Johnny Carson show, that to me was just heaven. I mean, I don't believe I ever laughed harder in my life than when he would make an appearance on that show.
Well, the album Hello Dummy is worth every penny if you can find one in a flea market. It's now available online, I'm sure, but I couldn't agree more. Steve, it's a delight to meet you, sir, and congratulations on the work and on the fun that you have in doing the work. We really appreciate you joining us today.
Thanks so much, Jordan. I love being with you today. Thanks.
You've been listening to On Mic with Jordan Rich, this podcast produced and hosted by Chart Productions, on the web at chartproductions.com and on all major platforms, including iTunes. Don't forget to rate us and review us. Thanks for listening. Have a super day.